The Retirement Conversation is a series of episodes on the changing nature of retirement today. These conversations are focused on the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition, including career, work, purpose, wellness, social relationships, and leisure pursuits. You'll hear from leading experts in the field. You'll hear the stories of people who have created interesting second acts. You'll find out about practical ideas and tips to create your own. Retirement Wisdom was co-founded by Joe Casey and Dennis Wussman, two former business executives turned professional coaches. At Retirement Wisdom, our mission is to save people from a boring retirement. We hope you enjoy the series and conversations.
Today's retirement conversation is with Brendan M. Hare. Brendan is a recent retiree and the author of the book, From Working to Wisdom, The Adventures and Dreams of Older Americans. He lives outside Boston with his wife and near his three grown children. Mr. Hare worked as a teacher, college economics instructor, and for over 40 years as an attorney. He served as chief litigation counsel for a Fortune 50 company and later as the founder and managing partner of his own law firm. For over 20 years, Brendan built and guided a sizable national law practice with clients drawn from some of the largest corporations in America. Few experiences have been as rewarding as this book project. He spent 2 years traveling the country, meeting new people, and listening to them discuss their lives and thoughts about growing older. Writing this book has changed him profoundly. He hopes it will have a similar impact on readers. Brendan, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, no. Well, thank you. And no, there isn't anything else I'd like to add. That's perfect.
What led you to write your book, and why did you choose the approach that you did?
Oh, that's so easy. Drug company ads on the evening news. Every night, they bombarded me with the message that pretty soon I was going to be feeble, confused, and inept. And I got to say that none of that rang true for me, and from what I could see, not true for any of my contemporaries. So I wanted to get behind these stereotypes and find out, what do retirees actually do? How do they feel about what they do? And how do they find meaning and purpose on a daily basis? Now, I got to tell you, Joe, that questions about meaning and purpose were things that I had always avoided. I'd been always a very practical guy focused on putting bread on the table. And I really didn't feel as though I could afford to focus on these sorts of questions. But now, at this stage of my life, I just couldn't avoid those questions.
So what did you do?
Pretty arrogant approach. At first, I figured, well, I'll read a few books, and that'll take care of the questions. It'll just knock them right out. And I began looking for books on aging and retirement. But they weren't very helpful. They were, you know, mostly financial, which wasn't the issue, or academic and theoretical. Or they were sort of things like tips, you know, gardening is good for you, or how to retire in Guatemala on $10 a day. The next thing I thought, well, I'll go read the classics, the poets. And there I found, you know, beautiful language and exalted thoughts, but nothing that responded directly to my concerns. Popular fiction and movies were also a dead end. They just didn't have the bite of real life. So out of desperation, and it really was desperation, I turned to a subject that had never been suited to my personality, and that was philosophy. And when I did turn to it and began looking at it, I found that some things just never change. It still wasn't suited to me, and I wasn't suited to it. I found statements like, happiness is the meaning and purpose of life. That was just too abstract for me. I didn't really get it. And then I found statements like, when your work is done, retire. Okay, that was clear to me. But the next part of the directive was, focus on the empty space. That just left me scratching my head. It was just inscrutable. And really, at that point, I think that was the statement that made me conclude that I'm just going to have to give up and figure it out on my own.
But you didn't. What happened?
Well, I started putting these books away, and I came across a classic book by Studs Terkel, a classic from the 70s. And you remember, Terkel was a legendary Chicago newsman. And he wrote a book called Working, and the subtitle of it was, People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do. That book helped me when I was entering the workforce and had to balance family life and work life. And it did that by delivering on an emotional and intellectual level an understanding of the whole experience of working and how others were experiencing it. So I knew that as I was leaving the workforce, I needed something similar, and I couldn't find it. That was really how I came to the project. Now, the approach was really suggested by Terkel himself. The genius of Terkel's book was that he stayed invisible. And through a collection of oral histories, he created the whole sense in the reader that the profiled subject was talking directly to them, just as if you're having a cup of coffee with them. And that's really what I wanted to create. And so I had a project, and I had an approach.
There were a lot of themes that emerged, I think 10, if I remember correctly. Which one surprised you the most?
Well, the themes were an arbitrary method of organizing voluminous material. When you get transcription of conversations, as you know, they're discursive and sometimes disjointed. So the themes were just a way of organizing that. But they didn't really surprise me. But there were some surprises. And I think the first was that I began thinking I was putting together a book about retirement, and then I realized it was something that wasn't it. It was even more than about a book about growing older. Fundamentally, the book is about choice. And the people profiled in the book remind us that every day, if you want to have any measure of happiness or meaning or fulfillment, doing so is up to you. And a good life will find you or elude you just based on the decisions you make every day. Essentially, it's you're in charge in your own life and always have the power and responsibility to choose your attitudes to situations. Second surprise was the collection of people made me realize that aging is not just a physical process. It's not just the decline, but it's a psychological and spiritual journey as well. And the shape and quality and the direction of that is again, my responsibility. And after these conversations, I came to realize that some measure of contemplation is inevitable and that my aversion to philosophy was really misguided. It doesn't have to be rarefied or academic. It can be very simple and practical. And to that end, you remember Groucho Marx, of course, is a great comedian, but he was also a very practical philosopher in his own right. And he had one quote that really meant a lot to me, and it still does. And it's, I, not events, have the power to make me happy or unhappy today. I can choose which it'll be. Yesterday is dead. Tomorrow hasn't arrived. I have just one day, today, and I'm going to be happy in it. And the last surprise was, of course, the people I met. They were fascinating and inspiring, but most of all, they were generous. I was stuck, and I went to these strangers and asked them for help, and they responded very openly and thoughtfully and generously, and they helped me grow and change and enter another phase of my life. So as they become ill and some have passed away, I just wasn't prepared for how deeply that would affect me. So those were the surprises.
And your book contains 46 people with different backgrounds. What did they have in common?
You're right. There are very different backgrounds. They're from age 55 to 99 plus, 99. They're ethnically diverse. They're from all over the country, Florida to California, Texas to Maine. You had athletes, politicians, missionaries, Nobel Prize winner, U.S. Marine Corps general, factory workers. And at first blush, you'd think such a diverse group would have little in common. They actually did have a lot in common. And I think that the central thing was that they fully understand and accept that their time is limited. They all get the old Mel Brooks joke. You know the joke, Joe?
Yes.
Brooks
yes.
asked the question, if George Bernard Shaw and Albert Einstein couldn't beat death, what are my chances? And his answer is practically none. And I think this understanding of their limited time permitted them to really focus on the moment. As one of them explained to me, the most important word in the English language is, not was, not will be. For example, we're talking right now and having this conversation, but it's probably not ever going to happen again. So let's focus on this conversation and getting as much out of it as we can. The next item they had in common was they were bold enough to envision their lives they wanted to lead, and they were determined enough to pursue them, and they made the choices to pursue them. They didn't accept any negative stereotypes. So I would say they were changed by age, but they certainly weren't diminished by it.
A couple of people in your book, Nat Grew, he had a saying, he says, I'm in love with the present. And I found that theme consistently in a lot of the people. They were talking about how they continually look forward versus looking back. And they found that a powerful approach, I guess a mindset for them is the way I think about it. Did you find that consistently?
Oh, sure. Nat was a 75-year-old world triathlete champion. And he was very, very much committed to the present and very much aware of how limited his time was. His parents, his father and his grandfather before him had only lived to 76, 77, something like that. And so he, at the time I talked to him, was 75, and he was, somewhat concerned about it. But the one that really made that clear was a fellow named Susumu Ito, who was a first-generation Japanese-American who fought in the all-Japanese-American brigade in World War II. He had won an American National Award, Freedom Award, in recognition of his service. And he had experienced going up a mountain in the Vosges Mountain in France to save a battalion of surrounded Texans. This battle went on for 5 days, and I think something like 275 men or 280 men went up the hill, and of those, only 25 came back uninjured and alive. Seuss was one of them. And he said, when I talked to him, he decided at that point in time that for the rest of his life, he was only going to do the things that he wanted to do. And, you know, these weren't frivolous things. He became a PhD, taught at Harvard Medical School in biology. But he was 93 years old when I talked to him, and his wife was 91. And he told me that at that time, his mother had lived to be 103. And so he thought it would be wonderful if he could live that long. But he had the question, what should I do? What should I do? And his resolution of that question for that present moment was he should focus on what it was that he wanted to do, that what was the things that gave him happiness and pleasure and meaning. And that's what he did. That was a constant theme throughout of focusing on the moment.
People that experienced the theme under change, Anne-Marie, Hannah, and Derek Sanderson, those who experience some sort of physical or mental change, clearly this has an impact on how they continually think about their future. You do tell the story about the war. A similar story that I had was my dad, who passed away almost 30 years ago now, was a World War II veteran. He knew he was dying. I asked him, I said, so what do you think about? And he said, well, in 1942, I jumped off a boat in North Africa, and I put my foot down and I heard a click. And he said, figured life was a bonus after that. It really has an impact and changes the way they think going forward and impacted the way he lived the rest of his life. So these stories are just very powerful. I never forgot that.
You're absolutely right. And that was one of the common things running throughout the book, was that the people had either confronted death when they were very young in combat, had that experience, or from health issues, and they had that experience. One did it through adventure, a fellow named John Turk, who was 68 years old. He was a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. He was a lifetime adventurer, great, great adventures, kayaking across in the Pacific, I think from Japan to China, and he was just fantastic adventures. But the one that he was recognized for by National Geographic was he circumnavigated Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic. And this is an island that's 1,500 miles around. And he dragged a kayak full of supplies, and it took him basically 100 days. And at the end of it, he completely collapsed. He had exactly the same point that you're making, Dennis. And his view was that when risk moves in, when mortality moves in, we get very serious about life. You know, you shed all the unnecessary baggage, the ego. Oh, something shouldn't have happened today, but it did. Oh, can I whine about that? No, you can't. You have to focus on living. And you shed the materialistic focus. His point was that the risk that's involved in adventure can reveal the fragility of life and can deepen your commitment to living more fully. Now, I think some adventure can be very helpful in getting through this period of transition that people experience when they go from retirement to go into retirement. You have to go through a period of discernment when you're going to see yourself from a new perspective, or in you're reordering your priorities to match that new perspective. And so adventure can do that. I suppose another way adventure can do that is maybe the less risky type, fishing or hiking, when you're confronting nature. It can give you a sense of transcendence, a better sense of where you fit in the universe. Again, it can be very clarifying and beneficial to the whole process of transition and getting a new perspective.
What did you learn about how people deal with their identity in transitioning to retirement?
Well, one of the profile subjects was a professor of life cycle development at George Washington. And she wrote the most widely used college text on the subject. And her view was that this whole transition period is really an identity revision process. It's much like going from adolescence into adulthood, or from being single to being married, or from being married to widowhood. It's essentially an unsettled period where you're going to have conflicting feelings, and that period is going to last an indefinite amount of time. There's no set period of time. It's not, you know, it's not a three-week period that you go through and you're through it. It's not like a common cold. It's something that you have to work through. There's a radical change. I mean, there's going to be some disorientation. You're going to get rid of old habits and attitudes and defense mechanisms. You're going to come up with new ones. You're going to adapt to it by looking at, you're going to compare yourself, I think, to essentially different group of people. You're not going to keep comparing yourself to the 40-year-olds. You're going to look at the group around you. The other thing is that throughout this period, those questions I had always been avoiding, the big unknowns, are going to persist. What should I do with the rest of my life? Who defines me? I think what one thing you find is that if your identity is tied up in your work, you know, you're the boss, you're the chief, the doctor, the lawyer, well, that can be gone. And some people try to hide from this by continuing to work, not just because they love to work, which that's what they're doing and they love it, then they should keep doing it because that's great. But some of the people just continue to work because they don't have any idea what they would do, or as one person told me, they were just afraid of retirement. You hear these phrases, Joe, if I retired, I'd die. Or Dennis, I'm not going to retire. How much golf can I play? But, you know, you stay too long in a job and you're risking your good name and your reputation. It took you, you work, you know, 40 years probably to develop it, and can go pretty quickly if you stay too long at the fair. The other thing is, if your identity is tied up in your physical appearance, that can be hard too, because decline is inevitable. People I saw who dealt with the transition best were those who accepted these realities, and they viewed them as opportunities to focus not on the superficial, but on their development as a person, an opportunity to become the kind of person they really want to be. I think they understand that retirement, you know, when you get through it, when you get to it and you're comfortable with it, it can be a magical period. There's lots of good family life. There's love, interest to be explored, balance.
And what misconceptions do people in the media tend to have about retirement?
Well, you know, all the tropes of ageism permeates our society. We chuckle and grin to see seniors portrayed as cute and helpless and befuddled. And we even have a vocabulary for it. Dennis, are you having a senior moment? Or not so obvious, Joe, you're just as spry as ever. The worst of all that is all of this condescension is so sincere, and it's so accepted, and it seems so normal. Now, I have to tell you that I've been as guilty as the next guy in this regard. At the beginning of this book project, I was invited to spend a night in an assisted living facility for seniors to gain some insight into my research. And, I declined as politely and as firmly as I could. To be honest, the whole prospect made me feel deeply uncomfortable. I thought, what if old age is contagious? I got over it eventually, but it made me realize for much of my life, I really had very little exposure to the old.
Aren't you being a little too sensitive? They're just words, after all.
No, not at all. The consequences of ageism are real and really troubling. It sets up a dangerous loop. It tells you time has made you infirm, you're obsolete, you're worthless. And in response, and it's pretty natural when there's so much of this this messaging, to feel pressure to accept it and internalize it, and it becomes your view of yourself. And once that happens, there are really disastrous health consequences, both physical and mental. Studies have correlated the experiences of ageism with memory loss, cardiovascular sickness, low self-esteem, diminished will to live, even shorter life expectancies. And when you think of that, it's staggering because over 70% of American seniors have been mistreated on the basis of their age. And it's really remarkable that we put up with this because, you know, our generation, my generation anyways, you know, we changed popular culture, we changed the music, we changed politics, we changed civil rights. And much of that was because of just one extraordinary demographic coincidence. There's just a lot of us. But those numbers give us, you know, great energy and power. Just think of the names that label us. We were the baby boom. That's how we came into the world. And now we're going to depart it as a silver tsunami. With that power, we have some responsibility to stamp out ageism. And probably the best way to do that is to live a vibrant, engaged life well into old age and make it very clear in every opportunity that ageism in any form, in all its forms, is just completely unacceptable.
I had a conversation with a couple of relatives about what's age appropriate. And it's funny, being in this business, it hit me like a nerve. It was like, well, you know, you don't want to do that because that's not age appropriate. I was like, what does that mean? And it, you know, it got into a conversation. People have very different, you know, obviously it's different for everybody, but some people literally look at it and say, well, you know, we're all getting older and we shouldn't do certain things anymore. And I was like, that's a shame. But I realized how personal, and you know, and I also realized that people just haven't taken the time to really reflect on this. Therefore, this book is something that I'm going to make sure that they know about and they read, because it does cause them to reflect a little bit differently, I think, than just accepting it.
I think one of the reviews of the book had indicated that these profiles were, and I didn't write this, so I'm just quoting it, guys. They said they were eye-opening and inspiring. As I look back on it, absolutely. There are people in here who have energy levels that are just off the charts, nerve that's just off the charts, and, you know, mostly a love of life that's really just remarkable and inspiring. So, yeah, I think the whole thing about ageism, it just seems so wrongheaded.
And is this ageism peculiar to our society?
Well, you know, there are cultures where age is respected, notably Japan and Asia, and it's certainly not peculiar to, you know, youth-oriented America in the 21st century. In the course of researching the book, I reread King Lear and found that even Shakespeare had explored the impact of ageism and actually provided a powerful lesson on how to deal with ageist attitudes. When I reread Lear, I was surprised to find that, as it begins, he isn't feeble or already half lost to senility. He's strong and blustering, full of passion, self-assurance. It's the cruelty he suffers from his daughters that speeds his decline. They shut him out from their homes. They condescend to him remorselessly. They call him an old fool, a superannuated baby, and tell him it's time for him to be led by others. And, of course, he internalizes it, and he begins to even doubt his identity. And at one point in the play, he says, "Can anyone tell me who I am?" And he begins to adopt the view that he's despised old man, poor and wretched. So ageism can trick us into believing just because of our age, we're wretched and despised. But in addition, you know, in addition to exploring the whole subject, Shakespeare, in through Lear, gives some powerful guidance on how to deal with it. In fact, I found in it five words that I hope never to forget, no matter what circumstance ageism imposes on me. Near the end of the play, the Duke of Gloucester is another old guy in the play, and he's been betrayed and assaulted and blinded and cast out, and he breaks down and wishes to die. He's a real woe-is-me guy. And his son, he's wallowing on the ground, and the son comes over to him and says one simple line, a real truth, just five words. He tells him, you know, snap out of it, and he says, "Thy life is a miracle." That has to be one of Shakespeare's most profound and urgent lessons to all of us. Your life is a miracle. And the people in this book taught that lesson. They didn't do it in iambic pentameter, but they did it all in their own voices and in their own ways through their examples, but they all made the same refrain.
What impact did writing the book have on you?
It saved me from the folly of checking boxes on some bucket list and or from mindless busyness. It made me realize that pursuing a meaningful life, even in the mundane, on a daily basis, can be endlessly challenging and rewarding. I think it made me realize that right up to the very end, I'm going to have new hopes, dreams, and still have to confront the questions. What should I do? Just like Susie Ito, it helped me realize that one day can be a lifetime. So live it purposefully. But the most important lesson I think it gave me is that aging is not a long crawl towards death. It's an adventure. It's an opportunity to grow in empathy and wisdom. And really an opportunity to celebrate just the miracle of being alive.
You mentioned your background about how you went from a very practical person to, it seems like you've really enjoyed the transition, delving into this and the self-reflection of yourself, the philosophy, really interesting. And this journey that you're taking continues. This is going to continue for you. You've really done a tremendous amount of reflection for yourself. That's great. So one last question. What advice would you offer someone, perhaps people who are really practical, like a lot of us are, and spend our times not thinking about things like this, but who want to transition well from working to wisdom?
Well, the first thing you have to understand is you're going through something everyone experiences to a greater or lesser degree. You know, the process is unsettling, and it's disruptive, and as I said, uncertain length. You can't hurry the process. You can't get through it by checking boxes. You just have to internalize it and go with it. I think the next thing you should understand is that you shouldn't just drift. And don't be buffeted by society's messages. Have an idea of who you want to be. Now, the whole book is premised on the whole power of stories. And the stories we tell ourselves are incredibly powerful in shaping who we are and what we become. And that's, you know, I think everyone recognizes that. What I would suggest is read stories about how others have adapted, and you'll see another person's life, their responses to the problem. In doing so, that will reveal a truer version of your own life. Another suggestion I'd make is not just read about it, but I'd suggest you spend some time writing your own life narrative, a short memoir, as it were, 1,500, 2,500 words. And I think that'll help you understand who you are and how you became that person. This is the kicker in it, and that is you should write the memoir as you'd like to be remembered. Not just as it is, but how you want to be remembered. And then who that person is, and move towards becoming that person. Take steps each day to become that person. And I think this approach is a thoughtful one, it's purposeful, and it will lead to you living an authentic life, a life that you want to live. That's my suggestions.
Brendan, thank you so much for a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, guys.
It's really a wealth of lessons that come from the 46 stories that he profiled in the book, and in our conversation, while fairly in depth, can't do them justice. I'm curious, Dennis, what stood out to you?
Many things. Brendan went from being very practical. I liked his history, so his own story, in a sense, of being such a practical. You look at his background as an attorney, an economics professor, and he recognized the fact that that wasn't going to work for him when he got into retirement, and he basically started that transition to more philosophical and really started opening himself up to other experiences. By this book, he was able to, these things clearly had an impact on him. I think towards the end of the conversation today, he mentioned that, you know, he decided to live life purposefully. It was very important to him. So one of the lessons, I think, that is in his story himself was that even though you're a practical person and you can experience this kind of journey also, and it is very important self-reflection, just don't think you have to do it the way you did it before. So I think there's a lot of enlightenment there from that side. The second thing that struck me was when he talked about this identity and the transition challenges that people have, especially when they leave a career and they transition to retirement. And he mentioned that people lose old habits, create new ones, and they need some validation for that. They need some time to do that. And they should really be kind to themselves as they're going through it. One of our earlier podcast guests, Dr. Thelma Reese, mentioned the same thing. She says, you know, be good to yourself. This is a time of transition, and it's okay. But realize that you're going to have to change some things are going to change. People are going to change. People you meet are going to change. Very important things to keep in mind that it is a continuing growing experience. And then Brendan mentioned the identity is tied to who you want to be. His last point, or my last point, was the power of this storytelling and the way he chose to write this book was not only something that for himself was enlightening, but there's a power in reading stories, and there's a power in, because you can learn from others, but you can also learn a tremendous amount about yourself if you write your own memoirs and then write, what do you want your retirement story to be like? So the learnings that we saw the same, we had the same recommendations. Emily Asfahani Smith recommended that the power of storytelling was really something that resonated in her work. So I hope everybody enjoyed it. The storytelling aspects of this are phenomenal, and we can learn so much from ourselves and from others. So Joe, what about yourself?
Well, because I'm competitive, you came up with three and I came up with four.
Okay.
So real quickly.
Well, I'm going to time you. You only have 2 minutes. Go.
First is the impact of beliefs. I think he did a great job in talking about ageism, which is a hot topic in our society today. But he really fleshed it out in terms of raising our awareness on the impact of cultural messages, marketing messages, even from family members, so that we can really take charge of our own awareness and kind of be on guard. But I like the way he said to be able to choose your own attitude, really be someone that takes ownership of your attitude and is aware of some of the messages that are not helpful. Second thing is adventure. That was pretty unique in terms of our interview so far, things I read, in terms of how adventure can be part of the retirement experience, and he has some great stories in the book on that. Third, the whole topic of transition. He really advises taking your time. Don't rush. Don't check off boxes. At the same time, don't drift. And I particularly like the fact they talked about aging in general and retirement in particular is not just about the physical aspects. It's also a spiritual journey and a psychological journey. And he underscored the value of contemplation and discernment and the role that they can play in that transition. And then finally, point four for those keeping score at home. His quote was great, the five-word quote, "Your life is a miracle." Good thing to keep in mind.
Well, I like tie games, so I'm going to give you one more point. Having some fun here with Joe. That adventure aspect, he mentioned two things. People that had adventure and experienced change, illness change. There were some people we talked about in the podcast about going through some life events, whether physically or mentally. But it helps set their priorities. That was also a very powerful thing. So Joe and I tied at the end of today, 4-4. We hope you enjoyed it. Welcome to the noteworthy segment of our show, where we recommend an article that you may find interesting to read. It was written by Richard Eisenberg at Next Avenue, who interviewed Michelle Panner Silva, who wrote a book called Retirement and Its Discontents. Joe, what did you find about this article?
I thought it was very meaty and substantive, even though, as Richard Eisenberg notes, a little bit on the downer side, not an uplifting article, but some great lessons in it. First one, something we've written about as well, which is that many people actually become forced into retirement, either by their companies or other circumstances. And that really exacerbates the situation if they haven't planned for the non-financial side as well as financial side. Secondly, she talked about the impact on people's identity and vacuum that gets created by people who are used to having their days structured for them in many cases through work, suddenly now having to provide that daily structure. And you get the sense that people feel lost, and we've talked about that before as well. And then finally, point three, she highlighted that there's really two sides of the coin with retirement. And the first part is personal and societal. And the second part is the workplace, that there's a lot that can be done on both sides individually to prepare, but also more companies can do to help prepare people for the non-financial aspects of retirement. How about you, Dennis?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. So just building off that, the article is very well written, and it's a series of questions for the author. So we can't possibly cover all of that. It's rich with something for everybody. So, a couple of things jumped out at me, as they always do. First thing was that when Michelle Silva was asked, what made you do this project and write the book that she wrote? She talked about the inspiration came from her father. So there's a connection to the podcast we did today with Brendan Hare in the sense that there's a story, the power of storytelling once again resonates in this. And the power of role models also came out in this. She mentioned how people maybe decide to retire. And she mentioned in the article that, my father did it or so-and-so did it when they were 65. So I figured it's time for me to do it when 65. So role modeling and storytelling is important to reflect upon. That was the first thing. The second thing that she mentioned, the Charles Schwab 2018 Boomer Study, where people left their primary job or occupation, 17% said they weren't sure what will happen. That could lead to drift. It also reflects upon people that are moving away from something versus moving towards something. And again, we heard that today in our podcast about people finding purpose. And Joe talked a little bit about the challenges and identity that people have with this. And you really got to focus on changes to your life and focus on going forward and finding purpose. To that end, the last point was recommendations that she had. When she was asked what people should do differently or better, so they're less likely to be unhappy in retirement. And it's never too really early to start this and start thinking about it. Start making a list of what you enjoy in life. I found this interesting. Not just what you currently enjoy, but go back and take a look at the things that most interest you. And then she said, then channel the energy that you used at work into this. So there's a lot of thoughts here and a lot of good ideas for people and really good article and great interview with her. We hope you enjoyed today's retirement conversation with Brendan Hare. As retirement coaches, we at Retirement Wisdom help people think through their transition into retirement. We also help those that are in the early part of retirement but are looking for more from this stage of their lives. To find out more about us and how we can help you, You can schedule a free, no-obligation consultation with Joe or me. Simply go to retirementwisdom.com and on the top left corner, click on Get a Free Consultation. We would welcome the opportunity to speak with you. Thanks for joining us today on Retirement Conversation, and thanks to our guest, Brendan Hare. You can listen to all our episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com. Thanks for listening. Till next time.